All over the world at this present time, special events in World War II naval history are being marked by 50th anniversaries. This has created memorable interest by the younger generation whose fathers or grandfathers lived through that appalling war, which resulted in the annihilation of almost 60 million people. A war which, by the demonic powers of one man, Adolf Hitler, plunged the world into a nightmare of terror and misery. The battles listed in the accompanying leaflet cover the first group of actions recorded onto audio cassettes taken from the author's present series of lectures on World War II naval history. This audio cassette concerns the events in the Second War relating to the Battle of Narvik, when in that never-to-be-forgotten naval engagement, the path of duty became the path to glory. On the morning of the 9th of April 1940, a formidable German force attacked and captured the important naval port of Narvik in northern Norway. The 2nd British Destroyer Flotilla, commanded by Captain Warburton Lee, had arrived at the entrance to Vestfjord too late to intercept the invaders of the neutral country, and although instructed by the Admiralty to proceed into Offutfjord, leading to Narvik, to sink or capture German troop transports, and to consider recapturing the port with landing parties, he wisely decided to gather more information about the enemy's strength there before plunging blindly into the battle. It was as well he did, for having landed one of his intelligence officers at the nearby Vestfjord pilot station of Tranøy, he learned from the Norwegian pilots that 6 large German destroyers and a submarine had accompanied the transports into the fjord, and that to the best of their knowledge, they were still there. Furthermore, the harbor entrance had been mined. It was disquieting news, and he immediately reported this to the Admiralty and to Admiral Sir W.J. Whitworth, commanding the battle squadron of the battle cruisers Renown, Repulse, the cruiser Penelope, and 4 destroyers which were speeding to support him. In effect, his signal asked, should he attack? Warburton Lee was fully aware that his little flotilla of 5 small destroyers would be easily outgunned by the superior armament of the 6 big Maersk-class Germans with a total of 35-inch guns, which would doubtless be in prepared positions to repel attack. The Admiralty's reply was cautious. You alone can judge whether in these circumstances attack should be made. Shall support whatever decision you take. Conscious of the fact that if he waited until morning for the promised support of the big ships, he would lose the element of surprise, he signaled, going into action. At this time, there appears to have been considerable confusion between the Admiralty and Admiral Whitworth as to who had the authority of command over the operation. Later, in a review of the situation, Whitworth regretted that he had not countermanded the Admiralty's original order to Warburton Lee to proceed into Offutfjord, and instead have given firm instructions to the captain to await reinforcements of the battle squadron. Whitworth's procrastination arose from his annoyance of the Admiralty's insufferable action in issuing orders directly to ships under his command without referring to him. If the Admiralty had sought to address themselves to the Commander-in-Chief of the Home Fleet, Sir Charles Forbes, or of the man on the spot, Vice Admiral Whitworth, instead of their subordinate officer, the outcome might have been far different. For although the element of surprise would have been lost, Whitworth's decision would clearly have been to abrogate the Germans' tenuous hold on Narvik by sending in a formidably strong force to deal with the situation. Furthermore, the circumstances which led to Warburton Lee's heroic action need never have arisen. Unfortunately, he had been badly misinformed concerning the strength of the German flotilla within the confines of the field. There were not 6 enemy ships, but 10. These were the George Thiel, the Wolfgang Zanker, the Bernard von Arnim, the Erich Geiss, the Erich Kölner, the von Roder, the Hans Ludemann, the Hermann Kuhn, Willem Heidekamp, and the Anton Schmidt. They were large, powerful vessels, over 1,000 tons heavier than the British, each carrying twice as many guns. It would be difficult to judge whether, if Warburton Lee had had the latest information of the disparity in strength between his own force and that of the enemy, that he would have attacked. Nevertheless, armed only with the information given him by the Norwegian pilots, he gathered his force and entered Offutt Field. The British flotilla comprised his own ship Hardy, Hunter, Havoc, Hostile, and Hotspur of 1934 vintage, and they had a displacement of 1,300 tons, each carrying 4 4.7-inch guns. The time was 4 o'clock in the morning and the weather foul. So appalling the visibility, they only sighted land once, and that when they almost ran their ships onto the rocks surrounding the field. Compounding the problem of darkness were also banks of swirling mists and snowstorms. Their advance along Offutt Field was therefore painfully slow, with only dim stern lights being used to keep formation. The hazard of mines had been somewhat minimized by timing the operation at high tide, which also conveniently coincided with the surprise of a pre-dawn attack. Inside Offutt Field, meanwhile, the German flotilla, under the orders of their flotilla leader Commodore Bont in the destroyer Willem Heidekamp, were dispersed inside fjords against the possible danger of air or surface attack. The Wolfgang Zanker, the Erich Geiss, the Erich Kölner were in Hergingsfjord to the northeast, the George Thiel and the Bern von Arnim to the south in Ballangen Bay, the Dieter von Roder underway in the main fjord, the Hans Ludemann and the Kerman Kuhn oiling from the tanker Jan Willem in the Rombaksfjord close to Narvik, and nearby the Willem Heidekamp and the Anton Schmidt in harbour. It seems likely that Bont was well aware of the vulnerable position in which his ships were placed. If the British were to arrive and lay off the entrance to Offutt Field, escape to the sea would be impossible. But he was in no position to move for some hours, for in the rush northward to capture Narvik, some of his ships had suffered damage in the stormy seas off the coast. Furthermore, each of his destroyers needed 500 tons of oil fuel to make the return voyage, and this could only be accomplished by refueling 2 ships at a time from the only tanker available, the Jan Willem. A slow process indeed. By 5 o'clock that morning of the 10th of April, Warburton Lee in the destroyer Hardy, leading his consorts Hunter and Havoc, arrived off Narvik and entered the bay. Hotspur and Hostile, meantime, were ordered to stay in the main fjord to shell any coastal batteries that might engage them, and also to cover their withdrawal. In the dark, the 3 leading ships slowly, stealthily, made their way deep into the main harbour and made a circuit to assess the opposition. Here, there were 2 destroyers lying alongside an oil tanker and close by, 2 others. The Germans, still unaware of the British presence, lay silent at their anchorages. At that moment, for Warburton Lee, the situation could not have been more satisfactory. His information had been that only 6 destroyers had entered the field. Here were 4, which, if destroyed, left only 2 more to be dealt with, or so he thought. As the 3 ships swung quietly into position, lining up on their targets, the crews of each vessel pale with tension, waited to go into action. Only the lapping of water against the ship's hull disturbed the silence. Leading torpedo men, hands poised above the firing levers, and gunners, fingers wrapped around triggers, held their breath, fighting control that mounting emotion born out of a combination of excitement and fear. For Warburton Lee, it was a moment of decision. And then suddenly, almost unrealistically, the word of execution was there, barking out of the darkness, pitiless, irredeemable. Fire! From the quadruple torpedo tubes came the click of the tripping levers, the muffled roar in the explosion chambers, the hiss of compressed air, and the torpedoes were gone, their sleek bodies gleaming freshly from the flashes of the guns roaring out above the torpedo crew's heads. Surprise was complete. Of the torpedoes fired by Hardy, one plunged into the Willem Heidekamp after the gun turret blowing off the stern. There was a slamming explosion accompanied by the sound of tearing metal with a searing column of flame fingering upwards. Into the great gaping hole rushed hundreds of tons of water, cascading through ruptured cross bulkheads, forcing open engine room watertight doors torn by the blast, and pulling the ship down by the stern until her after deck dipped below the cold waters of the field. The explosion had lifted the ship upwards and forwards, hurling men in all directions, tumbling this way and that, clawing at anything that would save their bodies being slammed into an immovable piece of machinery or steel projection. It was in this apocalypse of destruction that Commodore Bont, the naval officer in charge of the invasion, was killed. Moments later, two torpedoes, carefully targeted, hit its sister ship, the Anton Schmidt, anchored nearby. The twin explosions momentarily shattered the dying echoes of the first detonation. Hit amidships, the booming eruptions reverberated across the already oiled layered waters, struck the cliffs of the fjord, and bounded back, compounding the harsh thunder of noise. At least one of the two missiles must have plunged into a magazine, for with the ear-shattering explosion that followed as the ship blew up, the Anton Schmidt literally split in two. With it came a torch of flame, orange-red against the dark background of cliffs. From the bridge of Hardy, the crew had a blurred impression amid the smoke of the bridge superstructure lurching crazily sideways and backwards, then toppling into the flame-lit waters of the fjord. But as the reverberations died away, there were other sounds. For within that sea of oil were swimming, struggling men, calling for a help that could be long in coming. Not just a few, not even a few score, but hundreds. For each of these Mayus-class destroyers carried a complement of over 300. No one will ever know what Warburton Lee felt at that moment. Possibly pity, but if so, then it was probably tempered by memories. Never to be forgotten memories of recent tragic events in British naval history, brought about by the onset of World War II, which was not of Britain's making or seeking, but launched by the half-crazed German dictator Adolf Hitler. Who could forget that first day of hostilities on the 3rd of September 1939, when the outward-bound Atlantic liner Athenia from Liverpool was torpedoed and sunk by a U-boat with a loss of 112 lives? Or of just 14 days later, when the aircraft carrier Courageous was also torpedoed with a loss of over 500 of her crew? Or of the destruction of the little destroyer Glowworm only 3 days ago, blown apart by the great guns of the heavy cruiser Hipper, killing 98? Half of Europe had already been invaded and crushed, and now the rape of peace-loving Norway had begun. Following the first torpedo hit on the Wilhelm Heidekamp, the two destroyers Hans Ludemann and the Hermann Kuhn, which had been secured alongside the oil tanker, hurriedly came around the point and opened fire. In those intervening moments, the Hans Ludemann drifted close to the Anton Schmidt. But when the latter was torpedoed and blew up only 40 yards away, the shockwaves wrecked her engines, forcing her to swing away out of control. While this action was going on, Hunter and Havoc had intercepted the Hermann Kuhn and scored two direct hits from their guns, causing her to turn away. Within seconds, they encountered the Von Reuter, underway in the main field, which put up a stubborn resistance, firing guns and torpedoes, all of which proved ineffective. Gunfire from the British destroyers, however, swept the decks of the ship, and with her forward deck and superstructure ablaze, she lost control and rammed the pier. They then turned their attention to the merchant ships. At this point, it seemed to Warburton Lee that he had completed the task assigned to him. Two destroyers had been sunk, a third was ablaze, another made immobile from engine failure, and the fifth suffering such damage from shell hits that her fire control equipment was out of action. Six merchant ships had also been sunk. Out of the six enemy destroyers reported as having entered the field, it appeared to Warburton Lee that his flotilla had eliminated all but one. As it was nearly 6 o'clock, with the dawn light rapidly dispelling the darkness and the mist, he decided it was time to leave. And having signaled to the others to follow, he headed westward along Offutt Field towards the exit to the sea. It was then that the luck, which had so far walked hand in hand with him, deserted him. Out of the mist and dawn light to the northeast, from the mouth of Herschingsfjord, came speeding three German destroyers, the Wolfgang Zanker, the Erich Geiss, and the Erich Kölner, their forward guns straddling the British ships. This unexpected attack placed Warburton Lee's flotilla in a most vulnerable situation, for in the flight westward at top speed, their stern guns were no match for the more powerful forward gun armament of their pursuers. Came a mighty crash and explosion on the bridge of Hardy, accompanied by a blinding flash, disintegrating that little world of control, an earthquake blinding the senses, metal shattering everywhere, with the platform deck leaping amid a sheet of flame. There were seven men on the bridge when the shells landed. It catapulted them always into one another and into bone-breaking metal. As the acrid fumes and smoke cleared away, only two men were left alive. One was Paymaster Lieutenant Stanning, who had come onto the bridge simply as a spectator, and the other, Captain Warburton Lee, so mortally wounded, however, that the end could not be far away. Stanning, also badly wounded, was now the only officer left to take command. And with the ship still speeding forward out of control, he fought his way to the wheelhouse and, finding the helmsman dead, took over the wheel himself until later relieved by a seaman. Then suddenly, another burst of shells hit Hardy, causing havoc in the engine room, the ship to lose power, and the forward deck to become a mass of flame. As the heat of the engine slowly died and the destroyer lost way, he realized there was no hope of escape and no way to save the ship. With the blood-covered Warburton Lee at his feet, barely alive, the responsibility of the ship had, in an instant of time, become his. Looking around, he saw to his horror that their consort Hunter had also been hit, was ablaze and almost stationary. Even as he watched, the tragedy was compounded as the closely following Hotspur, hit by a burst of shellfire, destroying all bridge controls, crashed into Hunter, locking the two ships together. With this setting target, the Germans lost no time in concentrating their gunfire on Hunter and Hotspur. 7 shells hit the latter before our captain managed to regain control of the ship from the auxiliary steering position aft, to the grind and scream of tortured metal and the throb of propeller shafts racing at full speed astern, he managed to tear the bows from the clutches of the jagged and torn steel hull of her sister ship and draw away. Then, with the water boiling white at the stern, Hotspur turned seaward to escape. But Hunter was done for. A blaze from end to end, ripped open by the bows of Hotspur, hundreds of tons of water poured into the little ship. Please turn this audio cassette over to the beginning of side 2.